The next case for argument is 172603 Europep v. Eli Lilly. We're ready, Mr. Lucey, whenever you are.
Judgment below should be vacated or reversed for three basic reasons. The first being that venue was improper in East Texas. The second being that the court's claim construction was legally improper and created an indefiniteness issue requiring a new trial. And third and most importantly, we believe the four corners of this patent specification prove the invalidity for lack of written description and enablement of this broad functional claim from which nearly all of the disclosed embodiments have been excluded.
And with the court, can I just start you on the venue issue? We had a lot of cases this week, but after TC Heartland was decided by the Supreme Court, you all filed post-trial motions, right?
We did, Your Honor.
Okay, and none of those reference TC Heartland or the venue issue. Am I correct about that?
They did not, because the matter had been resolved pre-trial with the trial judge stating that we had waived the issue no matter how TC Heartland came out, and that's at Appendix 19-928. And once your position has been made clear and it's been dispositively ruled on by the judge, you are not required to continually re-raise it.
Well,
that's our
position.
Well,
we have a lot of cases that implicate this, and we understand it comes up, and you know this, at claim construction where it would have been futile to press this. In this context, though, isn't it a bit different? I mean, just Judge Bryson, before TC Heartland came out, said whichever way. Lawyers, on the other hand, constantly keep pushing on stuff that they shouldn't just because they don't want to have a waiver problem at the end of the day. Would it not seem reasonable to you that at least on a cautionary basis, notwithstanding what Judge Bryson may have sort of said as an advisory opinion early on, that once you had a Supreme Court decision that actually did it, you would have pressed that to the district court?
I think there are two answers to that. The first you mentioned, which is this was Judge Bryson who told us this. And secondly, this court did not determine that TC Heartland was a change in the law until the Micron decision, which came after this case was already on appeal.
Isn't your real problem not that Judge Bryson said you would be doomed either way, but didn't he say you would be doomed on either way, no matter how TC Heartland came out, because you never filed the proper motion? You didn't file an improper venue motion from the outset. You filed a convenience venue motion. That is very different. TC Heartland had to do with improper venue. You had never at any point in this case, until the eve of trial, argued venue was improper. And isn't that what Judge Bryson meant when he said TC Heartland wouldn't affect your convenience motion, because that's the only thing you filed?
That's exactly the reason why the Micron decision was essential in order to change his mind. Because we filed the only motion that the law at the time allowed us to file, which was a 1404 motion showing our dissatisfaction with that venue. And therefore, we were not adopting a wait-and-see posture. We were on record as not wanting to be there. And it was only after Micron was decided that his view that we had waived the issue by not moving earlier became improper, and there was no point in raising it with him prior to that. Now, the facts are essentially undisputed here.
I guess I'm just not following you. Was TC Heartland an improper venue case or a convenience case?
It was an improper venue
case. So you only argued convenience. Only argued convenience all the way through till the eve of trial. In the meantime, there is TC Heartland at the Federal Circuit, TC Heartland granted cert at the Supreme Court, then TC Heartland decided. All of these are under 1406, which you never filed a motion in the district court under, ever, at any point.
No, excuse me, Your Honor. We raised the issue before Judge Bryson, and this is where the interaction occurred, in the pretrial order before TC Heartland was argued and before it was decided, and were told preemptively that he felt we had waived it regardless of how it came out. And the whole point of Micron.
I see. So just to, I just want to, because I may not have understood the facts right, and so this is very helpful. So are you telling me that you did move for Judge Bryson?
We challenged venue under 1406 in the pretrial order before Judge Bryson.
Where could I find that?
At A2377 and 2384. And it was the colloquy on that issue that led to his ruling that we had waived it regardless of how it came out.
I'm sorry, I'm on 2380. Did you say 2384?
2377.
Okay, sorry, 2377.
Which I believe is the actual pretrial order. And 2384, which I believe is in the pretrial order, also raising the same issue.
So refresh my, Micron did say that you don't have to have preserved it before the TC Heartland decision was rendered, right?
But the legal consequence of
that
being...
That question is a friendly question. I want to push back on that. The thing
yes.
that's most weird is that you really didn't file anything. I mean, you conceded jurisdiction under 1400 before Judge Bryson. I don't know why we were talking about TC Heartland, why you were talking about TC Heartland with Judge Bryson beforehand, but you never ever filed anything beforehand. So even if he opined that it really didn't matter, there was nothing, as Judge Moore points out, there was only the motion for 1404. So it's hard to see that you can say it would have been futile for us to arrange it. You never actually filed any paper.
We raised the issue squarely in the pretrial conference.
Was there a ruling by Judge Bryson that we've got jurisdiction no matter how TC Heartland is decided?
That is how we read the colloquy. He said you have waived it regardless of how TC Heartland is decided.
Yeah, but there's no order issued with regard to that, right?
There is the transcript of the hearing, which is in the record.
So your whole argument is predicated on the fact that it was so clear that we were going to get a Judge Bryson, even though it was never squarely presented to him, and even though it was before the Supreme Court decided the case, he absolutely decided it so that it was not incumbent upon us to in any way, shape, or form try to preserve that argument by filing something after the TC Heartland.
It was presented. He did decide it. He decided it in a way that would not have been altered until the Micron decision, because until it is determined to be a change in the law, once it is determined to be a change in the law, you are not required to have anticipated it.
So, well, you're putting a lot of weight on Micron. I mean, I think our cases have suggested that at a minimum, the clock starts running on parties to have done something, at least when TC Heartland was decided. Micron illuminated the details of that, but I don't think parties could say that until Micron, we didn't have any obligation to do anything because the Federal Circuit hadn't officially ruled it was a change in law.
But we did do something. We squarely raised the issue in the pretrial order. It was discussed and resolved at the pretrial conference. And my point is there was no point in raising it post-trial, which I thought was the original question,
exactly.
Because he had said it had been waived and it had not been determined to be a change in the law. It was only the determination it was a change in the law that eliminated the waiver.
Why don't you, I've used a lot of your time, I apologize. Why don't you move on to the written description issue or the other issues you were trying to.
Okay, that, on the written description issue, which we regard as basically the core, problem in this case, to some extent, the case is a reprise of Ariadne. There was a.
Can I make him go back for 1 second? Because I just read the Bryson transcript on this, and he expressly tells you on 19-929, this is his preliminary take on this, and we'll see how TC Heartland turns out, but that's my view of the matter. And if either of you would like to comment, I'll listen, but if you don't, we can move on. How does that not I'm just confused about how that renders any further discussion of the issue futile. He's inviting you to tell him whether he's wrong. He's also inviting you, saying, but we'll have to see how T.C. Heartland turns out. So the futility thing is ringing hollow for me. I do see earlier where he says he thinks you waived it, but then at the very end of that very discussion with him, he invites you to comment further and says, we'll have to see how T.C. Heartland turns out before we can really decide this.
He said that he believed we had waived it no matter how it came out, and it wasn't how T.C. Heartland.
But we'll have to see how T.C. Heartland comes out, and you're welcome to comment on this if you'd like.
But it wasn't T.C. Heartland that changed anything. It was Micron that changed the ability. If Micron had said it wasn't a change in the law, he would have been right. We would have waived it. There was no point in raising that until
all right,
Micron.
I'll let you get on to your written description now.
Okay. Anyway, the case is in many ways a reprise of Ariad. There was the identification of a natural phenomenon that PDE 1, 4, and 5 were in the prostate. There was a hypothesis that you could treat a variety of diseases by inhibiting those, and then a claim to a method of treatment using any molecule that inhibits them. And the problem is that's an identification of the problem to be solved and claims all solutions to it, but does not do the hard work of actually making that invention. The things, PDE5 inhibitors is not a class of molecules. It's not like benzodiazepines. It's a property, and it turns out that lots of things inhibit PDE5, including a lot of natural products like horny goatweed, as you saw in the record. It is an extremely broad universe, and the record evidence of the compounds that perform that function are highly structurally diverse, that there are unpredictable changes in structure with function. And it was incumbent in that circumstance to illustrate a representative number of species or a structure-function correlation so that you can envision what the universe of molecules that did these things, inhibit PDE5 and be effective to treat BPH, were. And neither one of those were in the application, and indeed the vast bulk, and this is an exceptional point in this case, the vast bulk of the molecules actually described are excluded from the claim. And since written description focuses on written description for what is included in the claim, those things cannot serve to inform.
Is there a case that you can cite us that says that?
We cited a whole raft of written description cases in our brief, all of which focus and actually say, is there a written description of the claimed invention? All of the 112 requirements are focused on the claimed invention.
So do you think the judge below erred as a matter of law to the extent that he said the genus is defined by these 10 examples in the specification because 8 of them are expressly excluded later from the claim? They're no doubt within the genus. Everyone would agree they are within the genus, but they're no doubt they're later expressly excluded from the claim.
Well, this is another problem. The genus that's described is things that inhibit PDE 1, 4, and 5. There's not a single molecule identified in the specification that is said to be an inhibitor of PDE 5 and effective to treat BPH. There are a whole bunch of diseases. There are a whole bunch of PDEs. There's nothing that identifies a single molecule as falling within that genus.
Okay, but that's a completely different point than my question. My question was, do you think he erred as a matter of law to the extent that he looked at the 10 example species molecules disclosed in the spec, even though they are within the genus? Do you think he erred as a matter of law in looking at those because they are then excluded from the claim?
I disagree that they are within the claimed genus. And yes, he did err as a matter of law by looking at things that were expressly excluded from the claim as representative species of what is included. They simply are not. And I think the record is clear. There's no structure-function correlation. The Takasi article at 16019 says there's little information on the structure-activity relationships because even the most potent inhibitors have very diverse molecular structure, making identification of the most important sites difficult.
We're almost completely out of time. If you want to make one more point, either on writ description, or I don't recall if indefiniteness was listed in what you wanted to cover this morning.
Well, the core problem here, and the reason the case has to go back, and the reason if it goes back, it should go back to Indiana, is that the claim construction that was made here simply read into the claim a bunch of words that are simply not there. It said that the compound had to be selective. It said it had to be selective for PDE 1 through 4, even though 1 through 7 were known
so
at the time.
So is your argument on claim construction or on indefiniteness? That the claim is indefinite?
The claim construction was wrong, and it infected every aspect of the trial. The jury was given the wrong construction. There's prior art we would have presented if the construction had been different. It greatly altered.
Suggesting that there is a construction sort of cuts against the argument that this claim was indefinite, right?
No, because the construction given it is what created the indefiniteness. If it simply said PDE5 inhibitor, both parties said, yeah, that's something that inhibits PDE5. He now said it has to inhibit it in an amount that's 20 or more times more effective than 1 through 4. And the evidence, which we cited in our brief, was all over the lot that when you vary the conditions under which that test is done, you get different results. That's a classic indefiniteness problem.
Okay. Let's hear from the other side and
okay.
We'll restore some rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Your Honor. Just turning to the issue of venue right away, the key element there is that what Judge Bryson said is exactly what Judge Moore noted. I just wanted to put on the record that that's my take on this, and we'll see how TC Heartland turns out, but that's my view of the matter. For in order for the issue to be even remotely ripely ready for this court to consider on appeal, it was necessary for Lilly to have raised it in its post-trial motion.
An additional argument, which is we're not using the cutoff date that they once TC Heartland issued, there was still time to file a post-trial motion on this. He's arguing the clock starts to run from Micron. Do you have a view? That's the way I understood his argument. Did you understand it differently?
I don't believe that's true, Your Honor. I think the point is that in each, once TC Heartland comes out, there is this open question and to characterize it a free-for-all where people are rushing to now take advantage of what TC Heartland says. And so the question before various district courts is, now that TC Heartland has been decided and there is this new principle associated with improper venue, is that a change in the law or not? And there was a split, different district courts ruled differently. But what is consistent in every instance is that the parties involved, once TC Heartland came out, were for improper venue. And I believe, in fact, in Micron, one of the inherent powers that was associated with the determination of improper venue was, has the party been lying in wait? Has it been strategic in waiting to raise this issue? And that kind of a delay post TC Heartland was a relevant consideration. So the clock starts with TC Heartland, and by not raising it in the post-trial motion, Lilly has deprived this court of the opportunity to actually consider a fully briefed issue. We don't know how Judge Bryson would have ended up ruling on it.
Okay, why don't you move on to written description?
On written description, with respect to this idea that you can't look at the excluded compounds for purposes of written description, and let's narrow it down. There are four compounds in that list that are considered selective and potent PDE5 inhibitors, and two of them were excluded record. There's no law cited by Lilly that says that those excluded compounds cannot be representative of the larger genus that is being claimed.
You take their point, right, that written description is entirely predicated on what the invention is.
Yes.
And what is claimed in the invention. So if the claims exclude certain things, why are we looking to those excluded matters for purposes of specification support of written description? That intuitively seems right to me.
Well, when you think about the fact that we are claiming here a genus of compounds, and the question for written description, we're not claiming a genus of compounds, I apologize. We're claiming a method of treatment utilizing this genus of compounds. What's important is have we disclosed a representative number of compounds reflective of the genus? And even though that genus may now have plucked out of it two specific examples, Those examples in the specification, as Judge Bryson noted, they are still available to be reflective of other members of the genus.
Maybe I've got the numbers wrong. My recollection is that I thought there were 8 exclusions in the claim language, and so what we were left with were only 2 examples in the specification that were actually included in the claims. Am I got my numbers wrong? Because you're talking about...
You are correct. But the record is, what is unambiguous in the record is that there are 4 specific compounds that everyone agrees are selective PDE5 inhibitors. There's a list of 8 excluded compounds in the claim.
So what are we left with in the written description in terms of covered?
In terms of members of the examples in the specification that are still available within the claim of the 124 patent, there are 2 available. And of those 2, in fact, are those are Zaprenast and MY5445. And to go to another point.
And why is that sufficient to meet the written description requirement?
Well, now we've got to go back to 30,000 feet and refute something that was said here by Lilly, which is that as Ariad makes clear, as does LizardTech, is that the necessary level of disclosure for written description is very dependent upon what a person of skill knows about this area of technology. And the more that the person of skill brings to the table, as LizardTech points out, the less that that person has to necessarily disclose, because you don't want to have to recite all of what is known and well understood in the prior art.
So there was evidence before the jury that these compounds were known in the art?
Oh, Your Honor, there's an immense amount of information. Appendix 13317, Appendix 14253-254.
Was there any opposite evidence? Did the jury here make a credibility determination, or was it all one-sided?
On this element, there was no credibility determination necessary. Even Dr. Rotella at Appendix 13791 acknowledged that there were hundreds or over 100 known potent and selective PDE5 inhibitors in the prior art, including tadalafil, the active ingredient in the accused product. So the background of knowledge was immense here as of 1997. Mature, well-developed field, hundreds of known compounds, prior art disclosing those hundreds of compounds that Dr. Bell went through, 2 specific compounds in the clinic with doses being used in humans,
If I'm understanding it right, this claim is limited to a method of using an effective amount of the PDE5 inhibitor to treat BPH, right?
Correct.
Okay. So what does selective PDE5 inhibitor mean? The word selective, how does that impact?
A selective PDE5 inhibitor is an inhibitor that inhibits PDE5 20 times more than PDEs 1 through 4, as determined by...
Okay, so wait. So then you have a list. It's going to be all of these selective PDE5 inhibitors, except not including these 8.
Correct.
And if I understood you right, you just said 2 of those 8 are selective PDE5 inhibitors. Are the other 6 not?
I'm sorry, are they?
Are the other 6 compounds which are excluded in Claim 1 not selective PDE5 inhibitors?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe there's any evidence to that.
You said 2 of the things in the spec are definitively PDE5 inhibitors, and 2 of the 8 excluded ones are definitively PDE5 inhibitors, correct?
Correct.
So what's going on with the other 6?
The record does not show what the specific nature of those inhibitors was. That was not part of the record or part of what the experts
were saying. This is really well known to everybody of skill in the art. So why don't I get to know about those other 6 if it's really well known?
I'd have to go back and go through the prior art to determine which of those remaining ones, what their IC50s are. And I wouldn't ever claim that, because as a non-person of skill, I don't remember what was in those among those hundreds of PDE5 inhibitors,
but
what these
the
fell
point
into.
Of confusion for me is, how is a skilled artisan going to ascertain from potentially billions of PDE5 inhibitors? And if not billions, if there's a dispute over that, I'll just say millions. Okay? So millions of PDE5 inhibitors. Now we gotta figure out which ones are selective or not. And that's really the issue, right? Because all 8 of these are PDE5 inhibitors. It's just, do they meet the selective limitation of 20 times or more effectiveness?
To be clear, I believe that our position is that they are all potent and selective PDE5 inhibitors. What I'm talking about is what, in terms of what's in the record, in terms of what people testify to, we have evidence on those 4. So I'm sorry, but with that caveat. But
none of what you just said helps your case as far as I'm concerned. I'm trying to figure out whether or not a skilled artisan has enough information based on this spec and this claim to understand the scope of the compounds that are going to be used in this method. You've given them two in the spec, only two when there's potentially millions. Then there's eight more expressly excluded in the spec. My understanding is the record does show the reason they're excluded is they're otherwise claimed. And so you would have run into invalidity, obviousness, or anticipation problems if you had sought to claim those. So, but you're telling me, but we don't actually even know among the eight that are listed here which ones would be selective PDE5 inhibitors capable of treating BPA. Too many acronyms.
So
now I'm really confused because a skilled artisan is going to know out of the millions of possibilities which ones are good, but you got eight here and you can't even tell me which ones are good.
Your Honor, they are, as listed in the claim, they are all inhibitors of PDE5 for purposes of this patent.
My position was
that I don't know their exact IC50s, and the point of dispute.
So why would you write a claim that would exclude, expressly exclude something that wouldn't be included?
Well, they're expressly.
You told me the way the court construed this claim, I mean, is it inserted this word selective in? Not sure where that happened or how it happened, but there it is. So they inserted the word selective in, which means not all PDE5 inhibitors are going to be included. Only selective ones. Selective means 20 times or more effectiveness. I understand all of that. But then you're telling me but you carved out of what should be included eight things. Why would you carve something out? You know, you don't carve out of a turkey a chicken leg, right? You're carving a turkey. You take the turkey parts. So if you're telling me you can't, there's no proof that these eight were included in the claim, why are you expressly carving them out? When you've indicated in the record reflects, these were carved out simply because they're already claimed elsewhere. They are supposedly nonetheless helpful or indicative of the scope of the genus that one of skill in the art would understand is nonetheless covered by this claim.
Your Honor, to be clear, I'm not saying that we don't know and it can't be determined whether or not they are selective inhibitors of PDE5. What I'm saying is that for purposes of the record that was on dispute, was everyone was focused on these four PDE5 inhibitors that both experts agreed were PDE5 inhibitors. And as a result, I today, as a non-person of skill, can't tell you what the exact IC50s of those compounds were. But what is the important background to everything you just said is it's not just two or four or eight. It's that a person of skill can go to these articles, Seibert, Saiki, Takazi, which is art of record, and can identify what PDE5 inhibitors exist among the hundreds known at the time that are selective PDE5 inhibitors with which you can use to practice the claim. So when we talk about written description, we are not focused on these specific PDE5 inhibitors. We are focused on the entirety of the knowledge a person of skill brings to the table, which for both written description and enablement, they can literally pluck these off the shelf and use these and practice the invention because the data is out there. The IC50 data, the selectivity data is out there.
So they can be plucked off the shelf by anyone of skill in the art, yet there are eight of them listed in the only real claim at issue in this case, but you can't tell me which one, despite how much did you charge your client for this litigation? How many experts did you work with? You can't tell me which of these eight, the eight expressly listed in the claim, are selective, but I should be confident that a skilled artisan could figure it out.
Your Honor,
even after probably $20 million of litigation in this case, you, the attorney arguing this case, have no idea which of the only eight compounds listed meet the claim limitations.
No, I'm saying they are selective PDE5 inhibitors under the claim that were excluded. But what I'm saying is I don't know their IC50s, and we are not relying on them for written description because, as part of the record, the parties have narrowed it down to these four specific PDE5 inhibitors. I'm just saying, Your Honor, that there's no confusion among the parties as to what was available in the prior art, as to what was known to a person of skill in the prior art, about what qualified for a inhibitor of PDE5 under this selectivity determination or claim construction by the judge. And I will also point out when you talk
about... You said there's no dispute. They absolutely dispute whether the disclosure of only a couple of these things would be sufficient to convey to a skilled artisan the scope of the genus being used. I mean, isn't that the crux of their dispute?
That's the crux of the dispute, but, Your Honor, I would argue that that really is just an effort at a do-over on the jury's conclusions of the credibility of the experts. Yes, Dr. Rotella said, even against this background of hundreds of known compounds and against the undisputed two that are in the patent, that a person of skill would not believe that he was in possession or that the inventors were in possession of the full scope of the invention, Dr. Bell testified otherwise. He testified about what was known in terms of the structural similarities of these compounds. He testified about how these hundreds of compounds that were known would give a person of skill adequate understanding of what the scope of the invention was. So at its core, yes, there is a dispute, but the credibility determination that is implicit in the jury's verdict is that Dr. Bell was found credible and Dr. Rotella was found not.
What was the structure?
The structure is a planar fused ring structure with a flap element, which was found to be consistent among the different PDE5 inhibitors.
And so every PDE5 inhibitor that has that structure is going to fall within this genus?
Every PDE5 inhibitor that is a selective PDE5 inhibitor has this structure. And to be clear, what's happening here is that the PDE5 inhibitor is competing with CGMP to bind to the enzyme. And what was known here in terms of these small molecules was that these structures were consistent. Their planar elements were consistent. This is very different from Amgen versus Sanofi when we're talking about antibodies.
My clerk just sent me something, and I guess we're just not entirely sure of the technology and the way that you're talking about it. I thought, and he reminded me, or he thought, and I'm parroting him, that the IC50s are how you determine whether they meet selectivity or not. Isn't that right?
Correct. Selectivity is
a
ratio.
You have no idea what the IC50s are for six of the excluded compositions, but you're nonetheless confident they're selective?
I'm saying that as I sit here today, I do not recall what the prior art says about their IC50s. That is correct.
So you don't know whether they're selective?
I, sitting here today, believe they are selective as included in the claim, but I don't know their IC50s because, again, as the record developed, those compounds were not at issue.
Does this record establish that they are selective?
The record doesn't establish it either way, as I believe, Your Honor, other than the patent itself calls them out. I'm over my time. Thank you very much.
Go ahead. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. Quickly in rebuttal, there's some loose language being used here. You heard the words potent and selective, potent and selective, potent and selective. The claim says selective 22, 3, and 4. And that is not described in the prior art, except possibly for a mere handful of molecules. And the fact of the matter is that a number of those molecules that are excluded don't meet that limitation from the art of record. The Seibert's publication at 17591 says that WIN58237, which is compound I, is not 20 times selective with respect to PDE4. And the Takasi publication teaches at 16020 that dipyridamole, also unexcluded, that's compound B, is not selective versus PDE2. And the fact of the matter is the reader is left completely at sea as to what is within the scope of the claim and what the molecules are, totally befuddled by this exclusion of things that are said to work at least for something, and without a reasonable number of examples or a structure-function relationship, that doesn't work. The idea of, oh, it's flat, that's just like the antibody cases. Oh, it's a lock and key. That tells you how the thing has to conform in three-dimensional space. It doesn't tell you what molecular structures give you that. It just says, well, if it fits, it works, and if it works, it fits, and that's totally circular. And on the last point, the word selective...
I mean, you and I can second-guess this all day long. I mean, I'm not capable of truly understanding it to be able to be sure whether I'm second-guessing it right, but the jury found what it found, and it's a fact-finding. And the expert testified that based on the two in the spec, that was enough for a skilled artisan to understand the scope of what's covered by Claim 1. I mean, what do I do with that?
Well, what you do with that is what this court, has repeatedly done. This is why this issue of written description is decided within the four corners of the patent. because juries get confused. They get confused as they did in Ariad by Kadish giving some
juries. Guess what? We get confused too.
By giving superficial, oh, yes, it's described. Oh, you would recognize this. Oh, you would recognize that. That happens in all of these cases, and we listed in our brief all the cases where this issue has been resolved.
But our court has held it's a question of fact. Yeah. Not a mixed question of fact and law, a question of fact.
It is.
And we haven't found necessary to change that. So that's the standard of review we're living under based on it being a question of fact and time.
But it is a question of fact based on the four corners of the patent. And these wildly speculative research projects of finding things that worked have been repeatedly struck down on JMOL and summary judgment for that reason. And if I can make one last point, the word selective should never be in this claim. It's not there. The parent application, the 061 patent, specifically had the word selective in it. This one doesn't have selective in it. It said it was selective for PDE4 and or 5, meaning selective doesn't mean just one PDE. And there's certainly nothing that reads into that claim the 20-fold number that came out of an assay simply looking to determine what was there. So we think the claim is wrong as a matter of law, that there needs to be a new trial no matter what. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We thank both sides, and the case is submitted.